Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply.
Mary redeemed a $50,000 cash prize playing Chumba Casino this year.
I was only playing for fun, so winning this was a dream come true.
Chumba Casino is America's number one social casino experience. It's serious fun. With over 80 casino-style games to choose from, you too could win life-changing amounts of cash. Be like Mary. Log on to ChumbaCasino.com and give them a whirl. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void or prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. The voice in the preceding commercial was not the actual voice of a winner.
Hello and welcome to the Autosport Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Kalanorkas. Today is a special episode because we're also recording a joint episode for our Race of My Life podcast series. As it's the week between the two Formula One races in Austria, the opening rounds of the 2020 season, we're going to start with a dedicated discussion about the Austrian Grand Prix and the Red Bull Ring. With me are two guests. My first is Autosports Plus editor James Newbold. Welcome back to the podcast, James. How are you this morning?
Very good, thank you. Looking forward to chatting about the Red Bull Ring. It's one of the first circuits that I visited outside the UK. It's a brilliant one to visit. Everybody should put it on their bucket list. And if they like Red Bull, then that's a bonus because you're going to struggle to get any Diet Coke there.
Absolutely, I agree with that. I honestly think it's probably the most beautiful track I've ever been to. It's absolutely astonishing. So yeah, I definitely second that, James. And I know another reason why you're very excited to be on the podcast is because of who our second guest is. And I'm delighted to say it's ex-Jaguar, Red Bull and HRT Formula One driver, amongst many other things in your career, of course, Christian. It's Christian Kleen. Welcome to the Autosport Podcast. How are you doing?
Thank you very much. I'm very well. And it's a pleasure for me to be on the Autosport podcast. Looking forward to chat with you guys.
Wonderful, wonderful. Now, I'm going to ruin it a little bit for the listeners by just describing what I can see in the background of your Zoom background, Christian. It's lots of helmets and trophies. This is a wonderful setup. Where are you in your house? You're in a dedicated celebration room for your career.
No, it's actually my office here. And nice. Of course, I have all the helmets and trophies with me. It's nice. It's good memory. And it's just they get quite dusty, so it's a lot of work to clean them up.
keeping them going, I can imagine. Well, yeah, that's great. I mean, that is, it's the perfect setting for it, because as we're going to come to later on in the podcast, we are going to talk about your greatest moment, your greatest triumphs, maybe a couple of bittersweet moments in there as well, I think. But first of all, as I said, as we're recording, just to let everybody know, the listeners, we are recording remotely in the run-up to the first race in Austria this weekend, although we won't be publishing this episode until, as I said, the week between the two races. But as we've got Christian here, we thought we'd get your thoughts about the race, the Austrian Grand Prix, and racing in Austria. Now, it's, as James and I said, it's an absolutely beautiful track, not a very long one, the Red Bull Ring. What do you make of it? What's it like for a driver?
If you look at it on a track map, it looks actually very simple. Not that many corners and from the first look, a very easy layout. What's nice about the Austrian Grand Prix or the Red Bull Ring, I mean, the scenery around it is just beautiful. You know, in the middle of the mountains, the forests, it's just nice. But in terms of track, you know, it's a typical stop-and-go racetrack, which usually gives you good racing because there's a lot of overtaking possibilities. What we also have seen in the last years. And then you have the middle sector, last sector, which is quite fast and flowing. So to drive there, it's nice, but it's also tricky, you know, to hit that apex in that turn 1, 3, 4. It's not that easy, and you have to keep up the momentum. Yeah?
Absolutely. Now, James, I know you've got a certain affinity with the Red Bull Ring, because I can remember commissioning and publishing a feature we ran on autosport.com, which was your favourite race you watched growing up, which was it the 2001 Austrian Grand Prix? Big fan of the Red Bull Ring, or the A1 Ring as it was then.
Indeed, yeah, that was one of the very first races that I actually watched. It was Juan Pablo Montoya was in the lead in the first stint on wilting Michelin tyres, trying to keep Michael Schumacher behind him. And he basically took them both off the track trying to defend. You had Jos Verstappen with a light fuel load in the arrows, was running second as a result of that. And David Coulthard managed to outfox Rubens Barrichello with a long first stint, and right at the end you had the controversy of Barrichello letting Schumacher through on the final lap. So a brilliant Grand Prix, and I've kind of always enjoyed watching races there. The race that I mentioned earlier attending was the European Le Mans Series race in 2014, which Christian was a part of. He was racing in the Morand Sport Morgan, and he ended up finishing fifth. And the reason for that was because you had a teammate, Christian, who was rather too eager coming into the pit lane on a couple of occasions, I remember.
Exactly, yes, I remember that. And obviously, it was my home Grand Prix. I didn't have any home Grand Prix in Formula 1, unfortunately, because there was a 10-year break at the Red Bull Ring when I was in Formula 1. But anyway, in the Le Mans Series, I was racing there and hoping, obviously, for a podium or even for a race victory. And it was going actually very well. But as it is in endurance racing, you'll have also other drivers. And I remember the teammate, he was, as you said, very eager coming into the pits, crossing the line twice. And I think we got twice the drive-through for that and finishing P5th, unfortunately, yeah.
Yeah, once is perhaps forgivable, twice maybe less so. But as you say, you were quite unfortunate, really, with your timing, because you arrived in Formula 1 in 2004 just as the Red Bull Ring, the A1 Ring as it was then, dropped off the calendar. So when did you actually get to race there for the first time? Did you get to race there much in the junior formula?
Yes, I was racing there in Formula BMW for the first time, I guess. And then I was racing there also in 2003 with the Formula 3 Euro Series. I managed to finish twice on fifth position. So I didn't have the best results at my home Grand Prix, but I always loved it. I mean, it's a great circuit to drive. It always gives you great races because there's a lot of overtaking possibilities, especially in the junior categories with all the slipstream you can have there. So it's great, yeah.
And Christian, has it changed all that much over the years? You mentioned the 10 years that it wasn't on the Formula One calendar, but when it returned in 2014, it was obviously been massively rebranded as the Red Bull Ring, a lot of investment from Red Bull going on around the track. But the actual circuit itself, the layout, wasn't wildly different to what it had been before.
No, was actually the same, yeah. Same layout. Obviously, new asphalt was much better, more higher grip asphalt there. The curbs were a little different, but the layout itself was the same as it was in the A1 GP. Yeah?
And those curbs have they've played a bit of havoc over the years. I'm thinking Daniel Kvyat crashing in qualifying, I think, what was that, 2015, 2016, around then. But yeah, what are they like? I mean, the races you've done with those new curbs, and how has that affected things?
I mean, the curbs they have now, they're pretty flat, and because they use the track also a lot for motorcycles, so they have to find a compromise. And obviously turn one, but also up turn two, there's a lot of runoff area to be able to make sure, you know, people don't run off the exit of the corners too much. They invented this sausage curbs there, which I think they work pretty good, especially for Formula cars. It really shows the limit, let's say, of the racetrack. Not so much for GT cars, you can just run over it, so it's a bit more tricky there. But the way that the track is now and the curbs they have installed, I quite like it the way it is, because it shows really, okay, that's the limit of the track. if you go more, you break, damage the cars, and that's the limit, basically.
Last year, you were hoping to get another GT3 drive in the Blancpain series as it was then, and when that fell through, you ended up doing quite a bit of driver coaching with Porsche and the Red Bull Ring. What are the kind of the common mistakes that you see with people that are coming there that you're coaching that, as Alex said earlier, it's one of those circuits that people look at and on a map it looks quite simple, but what are the really common mistakes that people make there?
Basically, it's just they're going in too deep into the corners. So, you have to maximize your exit. After the corner is always a long straight. So, you have to hit your braking point perfectly, get that apex perfectly, and then make sure you have a really good exit. And most of the time, people just wanting too much, going too hot into the corners, and just fuck up the exit basically, and have a bad one on the next straight. And that's the same in Formula One. I mean, you have to hit that apex in turn one, turn two, turn three, just perfectly. Otherwise, you lose a lot of time. All the way up the long straights.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because the getting rid of all the gravel and replacing it with the tarmac kind of can almost lull drivers into that false sense of security that it doesn't really matter if you run wide. But as you say, it's that accuracy that I think is all the more important here, because it is quite a short lap.
Exactly. It's a very short lap. There's not that many corners that you can make a difference. So usually all the cars and all the drivers are very close together. So it's all in the details, and you have to maximize, really every tenth and hit every apex perfectly. And as you said, with the new track styles that we have since years now, with all these big runoff areas, which is great for safety, but it also means that there's no real limit at the exit of the corners, and even if you make a mistake, it's not dangerous. So basically you don't it's harder for to make a difference for the good drivers between the bad drivers. I mean, that's not the case in Formula One because they're all very, very good at the top, but in for example in GT3 racing, where you have pros and amateurs, for the amateurs it's much easier if they have a track with a lot of runoff, because they're not scared to crash the cars there.
That's an interesting point you mentioned there, Christian. It's actually, I'm going to throw back to an earlier episode of the Race of My Life podcast that we recorded, talking about Jackie Stewart and his choice for his Race of My Life. And I do urge any listeners of the Autosport podcast that haven't checked that out, go and have a listen to the Race of My Life series. But it's interesting, he said, talking about Monza, it was really satisfying to get a win there because the other drivers who perhaps weren't quite so good, the gaps were smaller because there were fewer corners, it was mostly straight, etc., etc. So how satisfying is it when you know that you've done just that extra bit at a track like the Red Bull Ring, perhaps Monza as well, fewer corners, shorter lap, just to take you clear of the opposition?
Yes, it's a really good feeling if you get that perfect lap out. And to get that perfect lap out at Red Bull Ring is probably even more difficult, because you have in reality seven corners that you have to hit perfectly. And if you make one mistake, obviously you lose more time than, for example, Spa. You have 16 or 18 corners. You have still 17 corners to make up that mistake you did, and that's you don't have that at the Red Bull Ring, basically.
Absolutely. Well, James and I both mentioned at the start how much we enjoyed visiting the track. And I said, like, honestly, such a beautiful location. Like, I almost didn't expect it when I first turned up, and you come through, you maybe go up. I remember walking up to turn one and looking through, because I was covering Formula 2 and GP3 at the time. And then, so I went from there to the support paddock, and then you can just see the hill rising up and the trees and sort of the mountains beyond. It's absolutely beautiful. But it's an interesting, really interesting place where the Formula 1 season is starting. Obviously, as I said, we'll have had the first race by the time you're listening to this podcast. But because obviously we've had the terrible delays with the coronavirus and the terrible situation around the world in terms of sport as well, it's obviously rolled up so many events, and now we are finally getting going in Austria. But it's a really interesting place to have started in Austria. Obviously, very fortunate, very wonderful that compared to other European countries, other nations around the world, the impact hasn't been quite so severe, which is fantastic. But in terms of the Red Bull Ring, it's the location that's actually been really, really key to getting the F1 season started. As I said, because Red Bull owns the track, I know they own a number of hotels and properties around there as well. And the fact that it's really quite remote, it's, you know, it's a long drive from Vienna and from even from Graz, which is the nearest city. So what can you tell us about the location, about Spielberg? What's it like in Austria there?
Yeah, it's quite a remote place, actually. If there wouldn't be the racetrack and all the hotels that comes with the racetrack, it's not much happening. It's a beautiful valley surrounded by mountains and forests. And if you drive there, you don't expect a racetrack, to be honest. So I think for a lot of people coming from other countries, it must be even a nicer impression than for me, as I'm Austrian. I'm used to this landscape. And for the whole country, for Austria, I mean, it's great that we have such a great racetrack, and thanks to Red Bull and Dietrich Mateschitz, who invested a lot of money in rebuilding the whole track. I mean, the facilities that we have at the Red Bull Ring is just top of the top, I have to say, and also the show that he puts that we have around the Grand Prix. There's so much more happening than just racing. For the fan, it's always been a really great race weekend.
Absolutely. I think my impression of it, where you suddenly hit all the traffic cues, obviously sadly not a factor this year with all the spectators that are sadly absent from the race, but yeah, then you know you're at a racetrack, because you're like, oh right, okay, here I go, I'm queuing for the traffic to get in, this must be the right place. Weather can also be a factor as well. I think maybe we're going to see some of the racing in the first two races get impacted by that. What's it like driving the Red Bull Ring in the rain?
It is.
If you've done that, I don't know. Have you ever done that? So that's probably a better question.
I have to remember. I can't remember, actually. But it's the asphalt they're having there is this high-performance grip asphalt. And even in the rain, it has quite a lot of grip. So it's not a big problem. The only thing is you always have these long straights, of course, and the spray might be an issue. If you go from turn one to two, obviously it's not a dead straight line. It goes a little bit to the right and then back up to the left. And if you're right behind the car, it's sometimes tricky to see where to go. But anyway, you still have eyes. You can look to the left or to the right. You follow the white lines and you're fine.
Absolutely. Well, it's a really interesting time to talk about Red Bull in particular, because I was writing for Autosport magazine, which is out last week, about how key that they are for this Formula One season, because Ferrari have come out and said, look, we think we're behind, we're in third place, so it's almost up to Red Bull to take the fight to Mercedes. And it's been a few years since they won their title. They've had some, you know, he's had some really good cars, perhaps, you know, obviously the engine factor and reliability has really impacted them in the last few years, but they look like they're really gelling together really nicely with Honda now. But I just wanted to ask you, as you know, you drove for Red Bull when it first joined F1, it took over the Jaguar team where you've been racing in 2004. What was it like back then, and how have you watched it, sort of, has it transformed? Is it much the same? What's it been like watching that?
I think for sure it has transformed massively. Obviously, Red Bull bought it off from Jaguar, and I think it felt like a little bit of a slow start. Let's say the first 3-4 years until the team got really competitive, but to build a top team, it takes time. Also, just to get the right people together. And we had quite a good year in 2005. It was actually the old Jaguar car, or designed by Jaguar still. So we had a very good start with Red Bull Racing, but then the second year got more difficult. But I think the way the team has evolved, it has changed very much. And, I'm still following it very closely. First of all, it's the team that I raced with, and it's an Austrian team, or owned by Red Bull. So we follow it very closely. And obviously, I'm hoping that they get back to the top. It has been a few difficult years for them now. They're getting closer and closer. And I think this year, they could have a real good chance to fight for the championship. They start off with Red Bull Ring. The last 2 years, they have been very successful there. So they have twice the chance to score good points there. And obviously, it's a very short season. So the less mistakes you make, the better the outcome will be, probably. And I also think the car will change a lot from what we've seen in winter testing to now.
And now, I also wanted to ask you quite a specific question, Christian, about Austrians and Formula One. I remember talking to one of my colleagues. He wrote a feature a couple of years ago about just how many Austrians are at the top and are in really influential positions in Formula One. So you've got Toto Wolff at Mercedes. Obviously, you had the late Niki Lauda there as well before he sadly died. You've got Helmut Marko at Red Bull. Gerhard Berger's previously been involved, obviously running the DTM at the moment. And Alex Wurz at the GPDA. That's a lot. I mean, like, just a lot of people from one country in really senior positions. It's absolutely fascinating to see. Is there any, because of course it's just, you know, not a huge population, Austria, but it's got a massive influence on Formula One. Why is that, do you think?
Yes, I was also wondering that myself very often, because there are a lot of Austrian people in Formula One, and also in catering, for example, or Franz Tost in at Alfa Tauri. We also call Günther Steiner. Okay, he's Italian, but he's from the northern part of Italy. We call him as Austrian as well. So Haas has an Austrian team principal there as well. And I think a lot of it comes from, I think, from time Jochen Rindt, Niki Lauda. I mean, Formula One was and still is very, very popular in Austria. And we have a huge fan base and people follow it. And if I think if a lot of people follow Formula One, you know, you get fan from a small age, and by being a fan, maybe you wanna, you know, your dream is to somehow work in Formula One. Doesn't have to be a race car driver; it could also be different routes. And I think a lot of it comes, yeah, from the history from Rindt and Lauda, that Formula One is so deep in the Austrian roots, basically.
It's time to talk about your race of my life. I'm really excited to listen to hear this, because this is it's actually the second time. Basically, just to give you a little bit of history, and also for the listeners of the Autosport podcast, perhaps haven't checked out the race of my life before. Basically, it's a feature that ran in Autosport magazine on several iterations over the years. It started out sort of in the 80s, brought back again in the 2000s, and now we're sort of bringing it into its almost third generation, as it were. It's the 2003 Formula 3 Masters at Zandvoort. It's the pick you've done for your race of my life. What can you tell us about that race, and why was it so special?
Why was it so special? I mean, the Formula 3 Marlboro Masters, if you're in junior categories, back then it was probably the biggest race that you could have entered. You have all the national Formula 3 championships coming together to one event. And if you just read the names of drivers who won that race previously, it's just phenomenal. And the thing was, I came there to the Formula 3 Marlboro Masters, didn't expect anything. It was my first year in Formula 3, and the plan was always, you know, first year is a learning year, second year you go for the championship. But then, you know, the beginning of the season went very well in the Euro Series already, and, you know, fighting for the top positions, had a win as well. And anyway, going to the Marlboro Masters, I didn't expect to be a front runner. And after qualifying, I qualified first in my group, so that means second on the grid. Nelson Piquet Jr. was on pole position. I had a really good start off the line, went into the lead, and Zandvoort is a track you can make the car wide. And I thought, look, I make my car as wide as possible. Nelson Piquet, he won't be able to overtake me. Also, he had a really good engine from Honda in that car. That was probably, it sounded different than all the other cars, and it felt like that in the mirrors as well. But I had a really good pace, and I managed to stay in front of him all the way through. Even after the safety car, I managed to get back into my rhythm and won the race by 0.3. And I mean, that race was just a breakthrough in my career, basically.
There were a few really strong names in that entry list, just to read a couple of them. Olivier Pilar was a second-year driver, your former BMW rival from 2001. Timo Glock was in his second year of F3. Your teammate, Marcus Finkelhock, also had a year of F3 under his belt. And there was the British Championship leader, Jamie Green, there as well, and Ryan Briscoe, who'd been dominating the Euro Series up to that point. What were you kind of realistically expecting at that point? Because you know, Mukka Motorsport, your team, hadn't actually entered the Masters the previous year. But when they had gone to Zandvoort in German F3, their best result had been an eighth place. So it wasn't like the team had kind of really shone there in recent years. What were you kind of expecting going in, and why do you think it turned out as well as it did?
Well, going into that race, from the team point of view, let's say the number one driver was Markus Winkelhock. He was in his second year. He had experience on that racetrack. And for me, it was, if I get a top 10 finish at that race, this would be mega. And that's how I went in. I didn't feel any pressure at all. Obviously, it was my first year. There was a lot of drivers who were in their second year already. And I just like the track a lot. Zandvoort is just a nice flowing racetrack. It suits perfectly the Formula 3 cars. You can play with the aero of the cars, and I quite liked high speed corners, and I was just immediately up to speed. And in the free practices, I thought, okay, I'm up there at the front, but maybe the others, you know, they didn't put new tires on or they're still playing. But then came qualifying, and I finished first in my qualifying group. It was just amazing. Having said that, also, I think we had very good support from Mercedes as well. Mercedes was the second year in Formula 3 with their engines. And they were also working very well. And we had good support from them, also from the engineering point of view, with their experience from DTM. So it just all worked nicely together.
It's interesting you raised there about the Mercedes engines, because in the previous years, the Masters had kind of been dominated by Honda and Renault engines. And that was the very first time that a Mercedes engine won one of the Grand Slam Formula 3 races, which is interesting in itself. I wanted to ask you about the tyres, Christian, because as I understand it, the tyres, the Kumho tyres that were produced for that event, were slightly different to the regular tyres that you ran in the Euro Series, just to give the British teams a chance to kind of be on a level playing field. But how different were they? And were the tyres something that you really got on well with?
Yes, I think that was a little bit of a benefit for the Euro Series teams. We ran with the Kumho tyres, and they weren't too different, to be honest. And we could run the same setup that we usually run. So we didn't have to go crazy different route. So I think from that point of view, from the tires wise, there was a slight advantage from the Euro Series teams, yeah.
And you mentioned before about qualifying. Zandvoort obviously is quite a tricky track to overtake on, with so many fast corners and not too many overtaking points other really than turn one. Was that something that you had in mind going into qualifying, that so long as you could be near the front end of the grid for the race, you could kind of defend from there? So it was more about setting up a car for one lap rather than a race distance?
My strongest point was qualifying. Even the previous races, like Manicure, I had my first pole position in the Euro Series. And what I did, most of the others, they went out the beginning of the session, they ran into traffic and didn't time their peak of the tires well. Where I usually waited, I could handle my nerves very well. I usually waited 10 minutes until the first guys came in to put another set of tires on or change something on the car. And when the track was free, I went out for one flying lap and hammered that one. And I was really on it. I could really do that very well. And I did the same in Zandvoort, and it just worked out perfectly. I had a very short run, did my time, positioned the car at the front, and that was it. I think that year, that strength that I had in me to do that one fast qualifying lap was a big benefit, because in Formula 3, the cars are very equal. If you're starting P10, you're stuck in traffic, it's very hard to overtake. Qualifying is everything. You have to position it at the front, yes.
Clearly, Zandvoort, Christian, was a track that you did get on well with, because you had pole position for both of the Euro Series races later in the year as well. So was it just a track that you particularly got on well with more than any others?
I think I got on with it very well. Yes, I really liked it. As I said, it's a really fast flowing circuit. It suits perfectly a Formula 3 cars. And yes, I really liked that track. And as you mentioned, later on in the Euro Series races, I had pole twice again, and I just loved it. Yeah, and usually it helps if you really like a track and everything goes well for you. You also perform better. I think it was a bit of a breakthrough in my career for sure. Right after the race, Norbert Haug called me, for example, from Mercedes, because not many know, but that year I was not only a Red Bull junior driver, I was also a Mercedes junior driver. So the budget for my season came 50% from Red Bull, 50% from Mercedes. And obviously Helmut called me. So, you know, I noticed, okay, this race is, you know, might have a big impact. A lot of people were watching it. Also, Formula One teams usually watch how the junior is doing in that race. And to be honest, after that, the Euro Series, it was just halfway through the season. There was still a big chunk of Euro Series ahead of us. And but I won races afterwards, and I finished second in the championship. And it was a bit of a dilemma, because doing another year of Formula 3 was probably a bit risky, because I finished already second, won the Marlboro Masters. It could go, there's a high chance it could go wrong the year after, if not everything works together as perfectly. And the other thing was Formula 3000 at that time was not the strongest championship. There was only one team, that was Arden, who won all the races. And those seats were full with another Red Bull junior drivers, with Tony Liuzzi. And I think it was Robert Dombros the year after who went there. So it was a bit of a difficult situation for me where to go. Should I stay another year in Formula 3, Formula 3000, or are they opening up possibilities in Formula 1, which in the end did.
Do you think you would have made it to Formula 1 without the Masters win?
I don't think so, because it brought a lot of attention to myself. You could clearly see a lot of people are watching that race from the motorsport industries. And pretty much quickly afterwards, there were talks, even with some talks with Jordan, and then obviously also with Jaguar, where I then got the test at the end of the year. Yeah,
I guess from a confidence perspective as well, Christian, you know, having gone into it thinking that, oh, I don't know, you know, if I can get a top 10, a top 6, then that'd be a good result. To actually come away from it having beaten everybody, yeah, that must have been huge for you going forward in terms of self-belief to think, I can do this at the top level.
Absolutely. And self-belief, it's such a big factor in motorsport. It's, you know, there's a lot of good drivers. In the end, it's to make the difference, it's a mind game. And the mental strength is so important. So if you win such a big race, it gives you such a big confidence boost. And I felt that straight the races afterwards. I was I had so much self-belief, and I knew I could do it. And it just made from one race weekend to the other a different driver out of me.
Let's move on to a couple of races that you selected didn't quite make the cut for your Race of My Life, which is always good. We like to have more discussions to talk about. And the next one up is the 2008 Le Mans 24 Hours. Now, this was after your Red Bull years in Formula One, not quite the end of your time in Formula One when you came back to race for HRT. But it was, I mean, fair to say, a very dramatic race. We know it at Autosport as probably the best Le Mans ever, because our sports car guru, Gary Watkins, absolutely loves that race. And it was absolutely dramatic. One in the end by Audi with Alan McNish, Ronaldo Cabello and Tom Christensen. But you were driving for Peugeot at the time. Wasn't a totally smooth race from your point of view. But yeah, I mean, again, a bit of a general question to ask you to sum up a 24-hour race. But yeah, how did it go?
I mean, it went actually much better than expected. It was my first attempt at Le Mans. And coming from Formula One, you know, the drivers, you think you know everything and you're the best. But then you come to Le Mans, driving in the night, having a lot of different other cars on the racetrack, like slow cars, amateur drivers, there's so much going on in your head, and to be quick on that racetrack, first of all, but then also to have the race pace, because managing the traffic is a big part of Le Mans. And that's where, for example, Alan McNish or Tom Christensen, they were so good in that. I mean, we with Peugeot, we had for sure that year probably the faster car than the Audi. But the way they managed the race was just superb. So we had to drive flat out, basically. And driving flat out in Le Mans is sometimes a mistake. What I had to feel, because we were... I think we were even in the lead. My teammates were Frank Montani and Ricardo Zonta. We were really quick. And then in one of my night stints, I did a very bad move on a left car. I was just too aggressive. I should have just waited another corner and nothing would have happened. But anyway, I dived in, wanted to make that move, and had a contact and stuck in the gravel for more than a lap. And we lost that lap, and basically the race win was gone. And you know, that mistake teach me so much for the later years in endurance racing, that sometimes you just have to be calm. And coming from Formula One, that was not something that you have in mind, because it's 1.5 hours flat out races.
It was an interesting time in your career, obviously, Christian, because at the time you were testing for BMW Sauber, you weren't racing in Formula One, you were still match fit, but in terms of the actual recent racing experience, you maybe hadn't had so much. So how tough was it, not only just to learn endurance racing, but coming from a testing environment where, okay, you can say that to a degree there's some elements of similarity there, because testing is all about consistency, and endurance racing is about consistency as well. But the amount that is going on in each lap, as you said, with the traffic that you're having to pass, how tough was it to actually acclimatize back to racing in one of the most difficult environments in the world?
Yeah, it was tough, but then your racing instinct, you don't lose that quickly. So 2007, I was a year out of racing, being test driver at Honda, and then I was test driver at BMW 2.8, and they and Mario Theisen allowed me to do the Peugeot program because he was quite keen that I have races under my belt, basically, not just being a test driver. And yeah, as I said, the racing instinct you don't lose that quickly. But what's new in Le Mans is, or if you do the first time an endurance race, it's just managing that traffic. And also realizing in this race, there's not only professionals, there's also amateur drivers. And obviously they're racing at their speed that they can, and there are their own limits. So sometimes they don't have the time to watch their mirrors. So you have to think for them as well. So that's something you have to learn. If you do the mistake once, you probably learn it even faster.
I can see that you've got the Le Mans trophy behind you. It's kind of distinctive amongst all the other trophies that you have. How was it just standing on that podium? Obviously, the atmosphere when the race finishes at Le Mans is unlike anything I've experienced anywhere else. Obviously, you weren't standing on the top step, but after 24 hours, I guess even a third place in your first attempt must have felt pretty special.
Yes, it was a great achievement. Standing up on that podium in Le Mans is just amazing. I mean, first of all, it's a very long week in Le Mans until you get the race, and then it's a bloody long race, 24 hours, and then to stand on that podium after such a long time on the racetrack, very hard times in the car, is just it's just a great release, basically. See all the fans at the bottom, 100,000 or whatever it is. It's incredible. And what I liked so much about Le Mans is, because before I was 5 years just on the Formula One races, and you're basically in this Formula One bubble, and you don't see anything. You don't see all the other motorsport anymore. And for me, Le Mans was just a little bit back to the roots again. It felt like raw motorsport. the fans were closer to the drivers, and you just felt more connected. And I just enjoyed that race so much.
And what was the what was it like when the car was coming back? Obviously, you know, you'd had your off, but it you know certainly weren't out of the race, and obviously you go on to secure a fantastic result with the first attempt. What were you thinking during the time as you guys came back through the field?
I mean, we lost the lap there. I was still in the car, and I felt terrible because it's not just I screw up my race. It's also I screw up the race of the other two teammates. So that's also a nice part of endurance racing. You're really one team, basically. You're three friends sharing a car, ideally. It only works that way, I guess, yeah. And you also feel like you let the other drivers down. But we had a really good team spirit, and we all pushed like crazy to bring back the car up. And to finish on the podium was just... was a great release for us and still a great achievement. I think it was also for Ricardo Zonta, the first podium in Le Mans. And not sure about Montagny because he used to race there quite often.
Absolutely. Well, let's move on to your next race that you put forward as a possible Race of My Life candidate. So we're going to jump back in time again. I like to shake things up, move it around, not necessarily do it chronologically. It's the 2006 Monaco Grand Prix. Obviously, very famous race in Formula One history because of what happened in qualifying with Michael Schumacher in the Ferrari, parking it controversially and quite dodgily at Rascasse. Fernando Alonso wins for Renault. It was the year of their great title battle, Schumacher's last year at Ferrari. But it was also a historic moment for Red Bull because David Coulthard, your teammate, secured Red Bull's first F1 podium finish. But for you, actually another case of what might have been because you'd been running in front of Coulthard. It was quite an attritional race, that one. Lots of contenders for the win dropped out in Raikkonen and Webber. But you were ahead of Coulthard when you yourself had a mechanical failure. So yeah, how was the 2006 Monaco Grand Prix? How did that unfurl from your point of view?
The reason why I picked that race, obviously I had a DNF and it didn't go anywhere. But as you mentioned already, it was the first podium for Red Bull Racing for David Coulthard. And in qualifying and free practices, to be fair, David Coulthard was clearly quicker than me. And David around Monaco was also always very special. He really likes that track, and he was really mega good. But the way the race went, I was on a one-stop strategy, and I was coming through the field, had a late stop, and just made up a lot of positions during my pit stop. Anyway, I ended up right in front of David Coulthard at that time, position 5. I had my stop later than him, fresher tires on the car. And, you know, in Monaco, it's very easy to make the car wide. So I thought, I'm going to get the best result for Red Bull Racing there. But I think it was like 20 laps to the end. All in a sudden, I got a gearbox problem and I had to retire the car. And I was sure I could have stayed in front of David. What we found out later would have been a podium, and being a young driver finishing on the podium in Monaco is just it can be a breakthrough in your career, and having a podium there I think my career could have ended up slightly different.
Well, yeah, it's interesting to consider. I mean, like, what was Red Bull like at the time? Obviously, it had been in Formula One for, it was its second season by that point. How much had it developed? Adrian Newey coming on board, but perhaps he didn't go on to have the influence at that time that he did later on with the Red Bull design. So what was the team like at that moment?
The second year of Red Bull Racing 2006 was very difficult. We went to Ferrari engines. Adrian Newey came very late, so basically didn't have too much influence on that car, and it was just a car with a lot of trouble, a lot of technical failures, a lot of DNFs we had. It was only later than 2007 that was the first car that was designed by Adrian Newey, and you could immediately see that that it's going to be a better one, clearly. So yeah, 2006 was difficult. It was not very reliable. It was difficult to handle. I think that podium finish that we got there in Monaco was just a, wouldn't say a lucky one, because the way the team managed the race was really good, and Monaco is just a special racetrack.
Of course, that was only your second Monaco Grand Prix, because although you made your Formula One debut in 2004, in 2005 you had the weird situation where you and Antonio Liuzzi were sharing the second seat, and you started the season, you had points in the first two races, and then Liuzzi takes the car over for a few races, he does Monaco, and you're kind of confined to the Friday role. And then you come back in later and you're kind of doing every weekend, thinking it might be your last race, and them always saying Tonio is coming back for the next race. So I guess the whole, you know, 2004, you come in, you've skipped Formula 3000 and you're kind of catching up. 2005, you've got that whole uncertainty hanging over you. And then when 2006 comes around, you must think, right, finally some time to get down and get on with it. But the Ferrari engine kind of keeps letting you down. Is it kind of a frustrating period in your career that you look back on and think a lot of these things were, you know, almost out of your control?
Yes, it's indeed a very frustrating time of my career. I mean, even though you made it to Formula One, I think 2004 with Jaguar, I was probably almost too young, not from maybe the way to drive the car, but from the mental side, it was a very hard learning curve for me. I was very lucky to have Mark Webber as my teammate. He was very open. He's a real sportsman, and I got most of the time a lot of help from him as well. So he was very open. That made my life a lot easier. And then 2005 obviously was very difficult with sharing the car with Vittorio Liuzzi. The positive thing, me and Tonio, we always kept a very good relationship. That made it easier for us. But it could have, with another driver or another driver pair, it could end up also in a disaster. And I mean, that idea to have two junior drivers sharing a car, and it was not only the races, it was also in testing. We had half of the time than DC, for example, as young drivers. So it was just definitely not good for us, and also not good for the outcome or the point scoring of the second car.
Well, Christian, we're going to come towards the end of the podcast, but I know that James wanted to throw an extra race into consideration. So James, why don't you introduce this one?
Sure thing. The other one I was researching, Christian, when I was looking back over your career, was China 2005. I think it's your best result in Formula One, but that's not the main reason I picked it. You finish P5. You qualified, I think it was 14th, and then you kind of make your way through the field, and the team makes a good decision with strategy that helps you, moves you up to fourth. But why I picked it was because you had the fourth fastest lap of the race, behind only Raikkonen in the McLaren, which was the fastest car of 2005, and the two Renaults of Alonso and Giancarlo Fisichella. And then there's Christian Klien in the Red Bull in fourth fastest lap. How kind of, we talk about in the feeling of being in the zone in a race car. Is that one of those times when, you know, you were really just on it and getting the absolute most out of yourself and the car?
Absolutely. And I think most of 2005 I really liked the car. The car was actually good. Even at the beginning of the season, we scored very good points. I also managed to out-qualify DC quite often. And I really felt in the zone with this car. And especially in China, last race of the year, I was very comfortable. I had my confidence back, because I had a long stint in the car after sharing the car with Tonio Liuzzi. And that race just went for me, basically. I remember there was Rubens Barrichello, who was holding up a whole pack of cars behind him. And the team did a good pit stop strategy that kept me out on the track, which was definitely the better strategy. And later on, the tires just came alive again. There was some graining on the tires, where everybody struggled with, and you just had to drive through that graining. The tire came alive again, and that's where the car was just great to drive.
You only had one set of tires for the whole race, so it was a kind of almost an anomaly looking back in Formula One's history. But yeah, it makes it all the more special, I suppose, that you were able to keep the tires alive to get that performance.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I remember I did a move again also on Felipe Massa. I think he was in P5, or I was on P6. Managed to overtake him, and finally was the best result of my career. And I remember, I think it was P4 and P3. I think Fisichella and Ralf Schumacher were ahead of me, and they were still in distance, so I could see them. And it was a weird feeling for me to finish a race where I could still see the cars that finished on the podium. It was a kind of a boost for me. It was a great race, a great result, and also that race secured me the race seat at Red Bull Racing the year after. It was pretty much straight after the race, Didi Matešić called me, congratulated me, and I think that was a big help for the season after.
Absolutely. Well, I always love hearing about a charging drive on a Race My Life podcast, whether that's the actual pick or just hearing them. That's always things extra special, more spectacular. Well, guys, I think we're gonna bring this podcast, this joint podcast, to an end. If you're listening on the Autosport podcast, I do urge you to go and check out the Race My Life podcast. Also go to autosport.com in a couple of weeks, where we'll be having that the feature. We'll be putting it up, all of Christian's words and dedicated artwork and imagery of the 2003 Masters at Zandvoort. So, Christian, thank you very much for coming on the podcast. You've been absolutely wonderful hearing your thoughts and your memories, and thank you very much again.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Excellent. And James, thank you as well for coming on. And I'm going to take this point to urge everyone to subscribe to your section of autosport.com. autosport.com plus is an area I know well, it's my old job. So yes, do check out all our news, features and analysis on autosport.com and autosport.com plus, as well as motorsport.com prime. So yeah, James, thank you as well for coming on the podcast. And thank you to our producer Martin Lee for editing this episode, setting everything up for us. And thank you to you for listening. Music is 6 AM by Trilo, written by Marcus Simmons. See soundcloud.com/Trilo Music.
Mary redeemed a $50,000 cash prize playing Chumba Casino this year.
I was only playing for fun, so winning this was a dream come true.
Chumba Casino is America's number one social casino experience. It's serious fun. With over 80 casino-style games to choose from, you too could win life-changing amounts of cash. Be like Mary. Log on to ChumbaCasino.com and give them a whirl. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void or prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. The voice in the preceding commercial was not the actual voice of a winner.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.